Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, white smoke in Rome as the first American pope takes the throne. South Africa's maths crisis deepens with over 400 schools dropping the subject. Sorghum in decline and your cereal bowl could be next. And night driving turns deadly as road conditions continue to worsen across South Africa. It's Friday, the 9th of May. Let's start with this, and Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost of Chicago has been chosen as Pope Leo XIV, and this marks the first time an American has descended or ascended the papacy. Known for his missionary work in Peru and his leadership within the Vatican, Pope Leo's election signifies a new chapter for the Church. Well, joining us to discuss what that might be and the implications of this event is Father Russell Pollitt, parish priest at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Russell, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the name, which is really interesting. Is his decision signaling a particular vision or aligning possibly with specific papal predecessors?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, to you and your listeners. Yes, indeed. The name is very significant. The first Leo, who is known as Leo the Great from around the year 400, was remembered for his very strong leadership and outreach to the world and his exceptional peacemaking efforts. He was a prolific writer, theologian, and many of his sermons are still quoted today. And he played an important diplomatic role when Attila the Hun near Rome in about 452 was trying to destroy Rome, and he, through diplomatic negotiating skills, managed to convince them to abandon that. And then we have Leo the 13th, which would be the Pope just before him. Leo the 13th died in 1903, who wrote the great Catholic encyclical Rerum Novarum, which was very progressive, and it was about the Church's thinking on workers' rights. A real watershed moment in the Church. Went on about fair wages, safe working conditions, legitimacy of trade unions. So we do, in the name, have quite a lot to reflect on.
And if you look back at that history that you've just outlined, and also the new Pope's past advocacy, how do you think then he's going to address issues like social justice and immigration within the broader Church?
I think he's probably going to keep to the line of what Pope Francis said about things like immigration. I think that the Trump administration, even though he is a North American, might find that they don't necessarily have a friend in Rome when it comes to policy. He is well acquainted with the poor of Peru, so he would know the real struggles of people there. And so I think he's going to be a social justice advocate. And I also have a suspicion, given what the Leos before him have done, he will address the issues of conflict in the world at the moment, which we see on the rise, especially if you look at what's happening in India and Pakistan.
So let's talk a little bit about that. We have accelerating conflict worldwide. You've rightly listed the latest one. What specific role then can the new pontiff play in international peace efforts?
I think one of the advantages of being a pontiff is that you don't have other kind of interest. So, for example, if one looks at the conflict in Israel at the moment, we know that American arms are being used there. So the pontiff is able to say things perhaps with a freedom that political leaders don't. And he's often able even to name the things, like I think Francis did. I mean, he used the word genocide, for example, which upset quite a few people in October last year. So he's able to name things maybe that other political players are not able to name. And even though we saw, for example, his peace efforts in Sudan, one remembers that meeting of the Sudanese leaders and the Pope kissing their feet, I think it was in 2019, even though that doesn't seem to have brought an end to the conflict, I think the pontiff plays a role in saying the things that can't be said, or symbolic actions like that to put this thing on the world stage, where maybe other politicians have interests that they can't necessarily address these issues.
And Russell, that's the external job that he's got, but also internally there is work to be done. There are ideological divides within the Catholic Church itself, and he's going to have to work hard and maybe even swiftly to unify progressive and conservative factions within the broader Catholic Church. And in fact, when he made his opening remarks or his first remarks, he referenced that.
Absolutely. He alluded to that, because I think even when reading some of the more conservative Catholic media, there's a sense of disappointment. They were really hoping for a break from a kind of Francis pontificate. They wanted a more conservative approach to things. Pope Leo seems to be more or less of the mind of Francis, not in all things. For example, one of the things that has come out, it seems, in the last 24 hours or so, is that he is not necessarily going to be progressive on women, for example. So I think he's got a huge job, and his idea of being a bridge builder is not just between the church and the world. He's going to have to do that amongst the cardinals and in the church. And my suspicion is he was elected because they suspect that this is a man that maybe is going to be able to tread that very, very difficult middle line.
And Russell, let me ask you a final question, and maybe just on a personal level. The election of a new pope, how does it impact someone like you, whose job is on a daily basis to run a parish? Does it make any difference to your life and to that of other priests?
I think it does, because we take our kind of cue for leadership from the Pope. He sort of gives a trajectory of where he wants the church to go. So we'll be watching very carefully to see what he says. We're analyzing the kind of words he uses, even as you pointed out to last night. I mean, a lot of us were saying, okay, it sounds very much like he's keeping the same line as Francis. He's emphasizing this bridge building, this encountering. So we take our cue from him. And he, remembers, will appoint bishops. I mean, he will sign off finally on bishops. So the kind of leadership we're going to get in local churches going to be people that he chooses. And so that will directly impact us who are working on the ground.
And I read Russell every day. The first thing that he does when he wakes up is he plays Wordle against his brother in Chicago.
That seems to be, yes. And I mean, there's been wonderful pictures of him even riding horses and things like that. I know his brother was interviewed by various media. His brother was in quite shell-shocked. And I was kind of wondering, you know, if his brother doesn't like something that he says or does, is he going to be able to say to him now, look, I don't like what you're doing around the dinner table?
Yeah, well, we know what brothers are like. Father Russell Pollitt, thank you very much indeed. Parish priest at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, recent reports reveal that over 460 public schools across the nation no longer offering mathematics as a subject, with provinces like KwaZulu-Natal, the Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and the Western Cape being notably affected. And this is an alarming trend, and it's been attributed, and no surprises here, to a shortage of qualified mathematics teachers, as well as resource constraints. And that has even led some schools to pressure learners into dropping maths to maintain higher matric pass rates. It's a worrying situation. I want to give you one perspective from Dr. Mogoena Maluleke, who's the General Secretary of the South African Democratic Teachers Union. Dr. Maluleke, a very warm welcome, and maybe just your view on the factors that are contributing to this discontinuation of maths at these schools. It's very worrying.
Thank you for having that. It's quite worrying, given the fact that mathematics is one of those particular STEM subjects that needs to be nurtured and be developed in our schools. So clearly for 460 schools not to offer mathematics, that to me is very huge. It's not just a small thing because we're talking about high schools here. And there are quite a number of factors, obviously. One is the fact that there's no proper human resource planning from the Department of Basic Education to then inform the Higher Education Department to say, okay, we're offering Funza Lushaka bursaries. And therefore, this is what we want to you to do at universities, produce these type of subject teachers and so forth. So if you don't have a proper human resource planning, you are not able to exactly know when in which year you're going to start experiencing problem about mathematics teachers or science teachers.
Is it just poor resource or human resource planning, or are there other reasons for this persistent shortage of qualified maths teachers?
This is mostly is about the lack of human resource planning, which we have also submitted to the minister to then say you've got to have a conversation with the higher education institution about your needs. But if they don't know your needs, what they are going to do is that they will produce teachers because their job is to train, but they will not train according to your needs because you have not given them the needs. Human resource planning would then afford the department to say in the next 5 years, we need universities to produce so many mathematics teachers. In the next 10 years, we need them to produce so many and so forth. And at the same time, they would have a plan that says those that are in the system, how do we ensure that we retrain them and train them in order to ensure that they are up to date with the changes in mathematics, the changes in technology, the changes in the economy. So you need that over and above that. So you bring in the second question, which is the resources that are required. So you have a buzzer that is called Funza Lushaka, because that is your weapon you have, and you know these schools not offering mathematics, to intervene in using it. It can't just be that it's determined by the applicant. So the applicant says, I'm applying for Funza Lushaka, and but I'm going to do this particular subject. That's not how it's supposed to work, because it's your only resource that you have to control your human resource planning.
You will agree with me, though, that it's tough to train mathematics teachers in this environment at the moment, given that the level of mathematics teaching at schools is so bad anyway, and that has created a vicious cycle, hasn't it?
Well, it has. I want to agree with you. However, if we go a little bit back about 14 years ago, VHETS had a program working with the Department of Education in Limpopo to retrain the teachers that are in the system. And it has afforded them that opportunity to be able to address the problem of mathematics teaching in our schools. So to me, again, is that I'm quite optimistic that we can be able to address this issue if we have a better plan, and then we are then able to channel the resources where basically our plan says that this is the intervention that we need. I agree with you. The poor teaching of mathematics, the results that we don't support our teachers, those who are in the system. But that program that VHETS had was very useful because it was supporting the teachers in the system, not only high school, but it was supporting throughout the education ecosystem, so that whatever you are able to produce and transfer the learners to senior phase, you transfer the learners that are basically grounded in terms of the basics of mathematics.
And the great tragedy here, of course, is that the absence of a proper mathematics education or a STEM education is also affecting learners' future academic and career prospects. And the domino effect is felt right up the value chain, because that has an impact ultimately on economic growth in this country.
Definitely. Education has got to be able to address issues of our economy, the skills that we need today, the skills in technology, they need mathematics, and the skills in artificial intelligence, they also need the basic mathematics that is only found, grounded in our students. So it's a value chain issue, and that's why we were sending our memorandum. We were very clear that the mirror of education is the economy. If the economy is not doing well, and there's a lot of unemployment, and there's a lot of graduates that have really graduated from universities but are not being employed, we need to go back and say, okay, let's look at our education system. What is it that is really trying to give us in this instance? What has it produced? And what informed those particular kind of strategies and interventions that have been implemented? So it's true, our economy can grow, and I'm very optimistic that if we do the right thing, hence we have taken a decision about improving foundational skills. as well as functional skills, and not just giving the people literacy and numeracy, but it's not functional. It has to be founded and it has to be functional so that we are then able to address the immediate needs of our economy as well.
And Dr. Malalecki, on a slightly different issue, a fortnight ago, SATU was threatening a complete shutdown over budget cuts as far as education is concerned. Is that still happening?
Yeah, we are still working on towards understanding how the departments, and in particular Treasury and Higher Education, Basic Education, are going to respond. We have given them 21 days to respond to this, because these are some of the resources that we need to ensure that we empower teachers and then we support our students. So it's still in the plans. We will then see how the ministers are going to be responding. Yes, one of the areas was the VAT. It has been done away with, but that's not the only one. The budget cuts are a real threat to education, and in particular what subject we're talking about now.
Isn't a shutdown also a threat to education?
It is. Hence, we couldn't just wake up in the morning and say on the 23rd we're shutting down education. We said here is a sounding shot for you to then wake up and understand that we are defending our students and we're defending our education system from austerity measures. You've got to, as government, respond to these particular things, because we don't want to go towards a total shutdown. But if we do not work together and find solutions to budget cuts, basically it is that we will be having people going to school but not doing what they're supposed to do. And we have our students really thinking that they are learning, when in actual fact they're learning to be at home and not be productive and not be contributing in our economy. So we need innovators. We need critical thinking.
Thank you very much. I'm going to leave it there. We are out of time. Dr. Mogoena Malalecki, General Secretary of the South African Democratic Teachers Union.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's healthy, it's drought-resistant, I'm told, and also proudly African. But South Africa's sorghum production is steadily declining, I read. Once a stable crop for households and livestock feed, sorghum now accounts for less than 1% of our total grain output. So what does this mean for our diets? Does it have any impact on food security and maybe even for your next box of favorite cereal? I'm going to talk now to regular guest Wandile Sihlobo, chief economist at AgBiz, to examine why this matters a little bit more than you might think. So, Wandile, a very warm welcome to you. And let's start with this. Why should the average shopper care that sorghum production is falling? What's the real impact on our food?
I think it's perhaps maybe in two ways. One being the fact that this is a crop that can withstand even the harsher climatic conditions, as you rightly put it. And I think then a wide growing of it at the times of climate change is something that we should opt to ensure that it's always part and parcel of our stable. That's one. The second aspect, it's this nutritional value side. And I think that what we are seeing now is a space where perhaps maybe more effort from a food technologies perspective is needed. Many people tell you that they no longer seeing the sorghum products in their shelves, but I think the demand for it is rather perhaps maybe more sporadic, because broadly farmers are planting less because there is no mass demand. But you have these pockets of certain people that ask about it. And I think that marketing and increased effort by food technologists on creating a range of products is necessary. And I think then that's the second aspect of why the consumer should care. It's that nutritional value that sorghum offers relative to the other grains.
Let me just pick you up on one of the points. It's seen as a traditional crop, I think. Is it simply just something that's fallen out of fashion, maybe in favor of maize or wheat?
I think relative to maize or wheat, what has happened is that maize, you could be able to get much faster yields. And I think even the usage of it, perhaps maybe there is much more choice relative what you could see to sorghum. But then the point there could also be raised to say, have we done enough on the sorghum side of lifting out of the ancient side? It can't only be seen as if it's a traditional and the old food that people use to consume, but rather rather to say, in the new ways of convenience, what have we done to ensure that the sorghum also sits there? And I think, Jeremy, it may help for people to look at it not so much as a substitute of another, but rather to have a rich, diverse diet so that people can have choice to consume various things, especially then when we consider that nutritional aspect of it. And I think it is why at least more research is needed here, because we are seeing in other countries, take the US for example, there are certain universities that increasingly are putting more effort on the sorghum side to say, how do we boost yield? What else can we do out of it? And I think in South Africa, it's that sort of a focus that is needed, but paired with the consumer marketing side so that there is that choice and awareness in a range of areas.
So part of the problem, if I'm hearing you correctly, would be farmer choice. There would also be market demand, as you've referenced. But is there a degree of policy failure here?
I would say a combination of policy and marketing is where, for me, I would place a lot of it, because farmers do want to plant the crop. I mean, I think back, Jeremy, now in 2014, we were worried at that time about the falling demand already. The only saving grace at the time, which we were looking at, was not even on food, it was biofuel, where we were thinking sorghum can perhaps maybe be a feedstock from there. But even that never really took off, to an extent that if you look today and you compare with how much sorghum we planted in 1990, the area planted has declined by roughly 50%. Output has declined roughly by similar percentages. So the key thing then is that we need to kickstart this. And I think the demand side will be the start. And then on a policy side, it will be rather more on supporting the research, especially that is targeted on yield improvement.
And also driven to an extent by climate change, because as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, droughts have become more frequent. So it would seem obvious then that sorghum should be rising, not falling. Am I right?
You're correct on that. Sorghum should be rising as one of the alternative staples that we have alongside with maize. And yes, I know people will say, look, birds eat a lot of sorghum, but birds eat also other grains. And I think it's really a round of saying, again, do consumers in South Africa know what we can do with sorghum outside of the traditional uses that we have? Have we developed enough products out of sorghum, just like we have done in other grains? There is a question to be made there. But of course, I mean, I know that people who are manufacturing food, they are running businesses, they have to think about these things thoroughly, which is why then I think some sort of an intervention, working with the grain farmers on firstly boosting that awareness, is something that is needed. A much more coordinated way of saying, how do we think about sorghum beyond the traditional uses?
I'm interested when you say we should be thinking about new products. Obviously, there's a cost factor, there's a health factor. What type of products do you think we should be considering then?
I think, Jeremy, if you look, for example, on a wheaten product, either it's biscuits, breakfast cereals, and a whole range of meals, we have that available for wheat. We have a range of some available for maize. The key question then is to say, why don't we have some sort of a product in that scale for sorghum? And I know, I mean, people like at the CSIR, for example, in their agro-processing unit, they have been thinking about these things. Some of the colleagues at the University of Pretoria, they've been thinking about this and Grain SA. But I think now done collectively at scale, and thereafter making sure that there is that consumer awareness, but you bring in the food manufacturers also on in the room, perhaps out of that, we could be able to position the sorghum in a slightly different path. Mm. And ultimately, when the sorghum planting starts to take off, I mean, it will not even be taking a market share from other products again, but it's rather that form of enriching the diet of South Africans and having a choice amongst many staples that consumers can have. And I think that's what we should be thinking about in here, that way of maximizing choice for consumers when it comes to food.
Just a final one then, choice is all well and good, but when it all comes down to brass tacks, is it better for our health and the environment compared to other grains?
I would say for the environment, all of these grains perhaps maybe in a similar way, it depends about how farmers farm. But I would say in South Africa, people farm in a very environmental conscious way because they know that they still need to use that land tomorrow and the next year and the next season. So that way we are marching in the right direction. In terms of health, I would say, I mean, all much of the scientific studies that we do see there, they do indicate that sorghum stacks up reasonably high than the other grains when it comes to the nutritional value, which is why then when you are thinking about feeding scheme, about all of the other things, sorghum should be amongst the diet and the choice that the students and the others gets to be able to choose. But then for you to put it in a feeding scheme menus, you have to create products out of sorghum that of course will be convenient for students but also tastier, and which is where then food technologists should be working on.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Wandile Sehlobo, Chief Economist at Agbiz.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, we've heard in recent days of two serious fatal crashes, dozens of lives lost, and one common thread here that is worrying: nighttime driving. Visibility is low and often the conditions are unpredictable. Accidents after dark are proving, I read, 9 times more fatal than daytime ones. In that respect, the Motor Industry Staff Association is now joining the Road Traffic Management Corporation in urging South African drivers to avoid traveling at night. But I would contend that's probably easier said than done. From the association, Sonia Carstens, a very warm welcome. And let me start by saying this, that we've heard this message for many years now, but road deaths after dark are still rising. It would seem that this is real proof that any kind of appeal doesn't work, and we maybe need tougher intervention here. Whatever that intervention is, though, I don't know.
Yes, you are quite right. We do need tougher intervention, and there's a lot of suggestions that we have, which is quite controversial. So, for instance, we know that our trains aren't functioning properly, which makes the amount of heavy vehicles on our roads, trucks, whatever, a lot more. And they don't stick to driving during the day. They mostly drive at night because they also have this perception that the roads might be quieter during nighttime. And that's really a massive problem because we've got heavy vehicles driving at night and making our roads much more dangerous and also limiting visibility. So there might be a solution in preventing certain vehicles from driving at certain times.
But it's also impossible to tell people not to drive in a country where the public transport system in many respects is broken. So to make a call not to drive at night would seem like either wishful thinking or just shifting the blame.
It is just so. You're quite right. It will be just shifting the blame. And in an ideal world, if our public transport were working, then we would see a decline in the fatalities on our roads. Currently, our railway system is failing us, not only on goods, but also on passengers. And that's why we see the amount of vehicles on our roads. Not only are the roads more busier, but nighttime driving has increased.
It's also a law enforcement issue, Sonia, that I would contend. For instance, this Eastern Cape crash that we read about recently, 15 people involved, and they were in a minibus taxi. You've got to ask the question why we're not seeing a more concerted national crackdown on reckless nighttime taxi operations. It's a question of accountability, isn't it?
It is. And you're quite right. We MISA commended Minister Barbara Creasy, Minister of Transport, for her efforts and the efforts of the law enforcement over the Easter period, with the reduction of 46.5% in fatalities. But we've seen an increase in visibility of law enforcement on our roads, but that was during daytime. And you're quite right that if we see that during nighttime, it will be a different story. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have, is that we need proper law enforcement at nighttime as well. And then the old problem, Jeremy, jaywalking. Pedestrians are fatal and they contribute to 41% of all accidents on the roads. That remains a problem during the day, during the night. Jaywalking must be punished. There must be severe action if someone is caught. That's something that our law enforcement enforcement authorities aren't able to do.
And the problem there, Sonia, is that civil society has to keep stepping in to do the work of the state if there is are issues like lighting, signage, law enforcement, as you've mentioned, and even the poor road conditions.
Even the poor road conditions and fixing potholes, something as basic as potholes. So I recently heard that there's a backlog in fixing potholes due to the fact that we had so much rain. But that's no excuse. I mean, potholes are dangerous. It's a potential life-threatening situation.
So as far as your organization is concerned, have you reached the point now where you're prepared to call for stronger policies? And I'm thinking of things like curfews for public transport at night or mandatory advanced training for night driving. Or are you just issuing a warning and perhaps joining the Road Traffic Management Corporation and not actually having the teeth to do anything?
No, we are working with a set of proposals that we want to submit to the Department of Transport with real suggestions on how can we improve the situation on our roads. MISA, being the majority trade union in the retail motor industry, are well aware of all the accidents. All the accidents contributed to potholes, to bad roads, because we get those vehicles to assess and to fix. And that's really a big, big, big concern for us.
And just a final one then, surely we should be thinking of things like automatic emergency braking or even drowsiness detection in all new vehicles. Or do you think the industry resists anything that might cost more upfront?
Yeah, that's a question of you've got that wonderful warnings, but the affordability remains a big problem in the industry. And we've seen a shift in consumers downscaling. So where you used to drive a luxurious vehicle, you will downscale because of the economy. So I don't think that South Africa is at that point yet.
All a question of affordability, I guess. That is Sonia Carstens. Thank you very much indeed, speaking for the Motor Industry Staff Association. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.